Something is sitting on the grass at Mitchell Field, Long Island, on the morning of September 24, 1929. It is a biplane, a consolidated NY-2, fabric-covered wings, round radial engine up front, nothing remarkable to look at, except for one thing. The rear cockpit is completely sealed, a black canvas hood stretched tight across the opening, blocking out every bit of sky, every bit of ground, every bit of horizon. The man strapped into that cockpit cannot see anything, not the runway, not his wingtips, not his own hands. His name is James Harold Doolittle, and he is about to take off. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today we are going back to a cloudy morning on Long Island where one pilot made one 15-minute flight that changed the way every single one of us moves through the sky. Before we go any further, a word from the people keeping the lights on here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSold.com. Now, back to that grass field. To understand why September 24, 1929 matters, you have to understand what flying was before it. In the early 20s, if you flew into a cloud, there was a very good chance you did not come back out, not because the airplane broke, because you did. Your inner ear would start lying to you, and it is an extraordinarily convincing liar. You would feel level when you were in a bank. You would feel like you were climbing when you were actually descending in a slow, lazy spiral toward the earth below. By the time you knew something was wrong, you were already past the point of recovery. Pilots had a name for it. They called it getting the leans. Every pilot who flew in weather in the 1920s knew the feeling. You're in the clouds, you cannot see anything, and your body is telling you something, and your instruments are telling you something different. And every instinct you have says trust your body. The instrument is a piece of machinery. Your body is you. And so pilots trusted their bodies. And pilots died. The airmail pilots knew this better than anyone. Those men flew the routes between New York and Chicago, between Chicago and San Francisco, in open cockpits, through whatever the sky threw at them. They navigated at night by bonfires lit on the ground below. When the clouds came down, some of them flew anyway, because the mail had to move, because that was the job. The mortality rate was staggering. Between 1926 and 1930, more than 1 in 4 airmail pilots was killed in the line of duty. 1 in 4. I want you to sit with that for a second. That is not a dangerous profession. That is a slow-motion catastrophe. And aviation's critics, there were plenty of them, used every accident as ammunition. Every fog crash, every pilot who flew into a hillside he could not see, every overloaded newsreel of wreckage in a field. The argument was simple. This whole flying enterprise is fundamentally too dangerous to trust with human lives. If it cannot operate in weather, it will never be more than a stunt. The future of the entire industry depended on solving one problem, weather. You had to figure out how to fly in it. Enter Harry Guggenheim. Harry was the son of Daniel Guggenheim, the copper baron, and he was one of those rare wealthy men with the vision to understand that the right investment in the right idea at the right moment can change history. In 1926, the Daniel Guggenheim Fund for the Promotion of Aeronautics was established. It funded research. It funded airports. It supported Charles Lindbergh's goodwill tour after the transatlantic flight. It put weather reporting stations along the airmail routes. And in 1928, it established the full flight laboratory at Mitchell Field, Long Island. The mission was not complicated to state, even if it was brutal to achieve, figure out how to take off, navigate, and land an aircraft without ever being able to see outside the cockpit. They needed the best pilot in the world. They picked Doolittle.
You may know Jimmy Doolittle from a different chapter of history. April 18, 1942. 16 North American B-25 Mitchell bombers lifting off the pitching deck of the USS Hornet, bound for Tokyo. The first American bombs ever dropped on the Japanese home islands. He won the Medal of Honor for that raid. He was promoted 2 ranks on the spot. He is in every rightful sense a legend. But talk to the pilots and historians who spent the most time with his full story, and many of them will tell you the Tokyo raid was not his most important flight. This one was. Doolittle had a background that made him almost uniquely qualified. He had been a stunt pilot in his early career, one of the best in the country, the kind of man who understood the edge of the envelope, not as a theory but as a physical sensation. He had raced aircraft and won. He had set transcontinental speed records, and he had done something that almost no working pilot of his era had done. He had gone back to school, earned a doctorate in aeronautical science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the very first such degree the Institute ever awarded. He understood aerodynamics the way a musician understands harmony, from the inside, completely. And he understood the instrument problem not just as an engineering challenge but as a human one. You could build the most accurate altimeter ever made and put it in the cockpit. But if the pilot looked at it and it disagreed with what his body was telling him, the pilot would trust his body, every time. That was not stubbornness, that was evolution. Every human instinct said trust what you feel. Doolittle's real project over the year and a half he spent at Mitchell Field was not just to develop better instruments. It was to develop a pilot disciplined enough to follow them when his entire nervous system was screaming at him to do something else. Three instruments made the September flight possible, and it is worth knowing their names, because something very close to each of them is sitting in your panel right now.
The first was the sensitive altimeter, developed by Paul Kaltzman. The altimeters in use before Kaltzman's were rough instruments, accurate to maybe a couple hundred feet on a cooperative day. For normal visual flying that was fine enough, for landing in zero visibility it was a death sentence. Kaltzman redesigned the internal mechanism, the aneroid capsule, and the gear train behind it, and got the sensitivity down to something approaching 10 feet of accuracy under controlled conditions. 10 feet. For a pilot shooting an approach into fog with no visual reference, that was everything. The second was the artificial horizon. The Sperry Gyroscope Company had been working on gyroscopic instruments since the First World War. Lawrence Sperry had died before seeing the full application of his work, but the company carried it forward. The artificial horizon gave the pilot a miniature aircraft silhouette on a round dial, with a horizon line that stayed fixed no matter what the real airplane was doing. Bank 30 degrees right. The miniature airplane banks 30 degrees right. Pitch the nose up. The horizon line drops, for the first time. A pilot could look at a dial and know with certainty whether the wings were level. The third was the directional gyroscope. A magnetic compass is a useful instrument on the ground. In a maneuvering aircraft, it is nearly useless. It swings and lags and leads with every bank and pitch change, hunting for magnetic north, with the reliability of a weather vane in a dust devil. The directional gyro was gyroscopically stabilized. It did not care about magnetic north. It held whatever heading you set it to, steady and precise. Fly a heading, and the instrument told you if you were holding it. Simple in concept, transformative in practice. And finally, there was the radio range. A network of low-frequency radio beacons installed across the country, each one broadcasting a signal in a pattern. Fly to the left of the centerline, and you heard the Morse letter N in your headphones. Dot dash. Fly to the right, and you heard A, dash dot. Fly the centerline, and the two signals merged into a continuous tone. Follow the tone, and you followed the beam. Follow the beam all the way down, and you cross the airport. It was crude by every modern standard, but it worked.
Doolittle spent over a year training with those instruments. Flying under the hood. Flying in real weather. Training his hands to make corrections before his body felt the need for them. Training his eyes to trust the panel and nothing else. Learning to treat the screaming of his inner ear not as useful information, but as noise. By September of 1929, he was ready. The morning is overcast. Low ceiling, not quite 00, but gray and solid, the kind of sky that would have grounded most pilots of the era. Doolittle climbs into the rear cockpit of the NY-2. The canvas hood goes on. He is now in a small enclosed world of vibrating metal, oil smell, and the deep mechanical roar of the radial up front. In the forward cockpit, a safety pilot sits with the canopy open, watching. His job is to intervene only if the airplane is about to kill them both, otherwise he does nothing. This has to be Doolittle's flight, on Doolittle's instruments, every foot of it. The engine runs up. The biplane rolls down the Mitchell Field grass. Doolittle feels the airplane come off the ground. That moment every pilot knows, when the wheel vibration goes quiet, and the air takes you, and he is flying, he cannot see anything outside that hood. Not the horizon, not the ground falling away below him. Not the Long Island coast. The only world he has access to is the panel 6 inches from his face. He climbs to 1,000 feet on the sensitive altimeter. He checks the artificial horizon, wings level. He turns onto course using the directional gyro and the radio range. He flies a wide circuit of the field. The instrument stays steady. His airspeed is what it should be. His altitude is what it should be. The wings are level. He begins the approach. Think about what he is actually doing in that moment. He is pointing an airplane at a specific strip of ground he cannot see, at a speed he is managing from a dial, at an altitude he is trusting to a pressure instrument, following an electronic tone through the air. Every piece of feedback his body is giving him is suspect. His inner ear is probably lying. His sense of balance is probably lying. The only truth available to him is those dials.
He trusts them. The wheels touch.
The biplane rolls out on the grass. Doolittle lifts the hood. He has just completed the world's first completely blind flight, takeoff, navigation, and landing, accomplished entirely on instruments, with no external visual reference of any kind. The whole thing lasted about 15 minutes. Harry Guggenheim was watching from the field. He said later that when the wheels touched, he did not know whether to applaud or sit down. Now here is where it gets interesting. The story of the blind flight almost always gets told as a technical story. New instruments plus disciplined pilot equals problem solved, but there is a layer underneath it that matters more than the engineering. What Doolittle demonstrated that morning was a system. Not instruments in isolation, an entire chain. Reliable instruments to tell the pilot the state of the aircraft, a radio navigation network to tell the pilot where the aircraft was, a standardized approach procedure to get from the navigation system down to the ground safely, and a pilot trained to trust the chain over his own instincts. Every link had to hold. What he built and what those 15 minutes proved was the conceptual architecture of everything we call instrument flight rules, the IFR system, standard terminal arrivals, instrument landing systems, precision approaches. All of it traces a direct line back to what Doolittle and the Guggenheim lab proved on that overcast Long Island morning. The impact was immediate. Within a year, the major airlines were equipping aircraft with artificial horizons and directional gyros. The airmail service began requiring instrument training. The accident rate began slowly to fall. By the middle of the 1930s, American commercial aviation had turned a corner. Not because the weather had improved. Because pilots had stopped being helpless in it, Doolittle moved on. He left the military, went to work for Shell Oil, raced airplanes, won the Bendix Trophy twice and the Thompson Trophy once. Then the war came and he came back, and there was Tokyo, and then North Africa, and then the skies over Germany with the 8th Air Force.
He retired a four-star general. He won every major decoration the country gives. He lived to 96 years old, and when he died in 1993, the tributes came from everywhere. From Tokyo to London, from Edwards Air Force Base, to the old airmail veterans who remembered what the skies were like before. But he always said the same thing when people asked about his career. When they asked which flight had mattered most, not the most dangerous, not the most decorated, which one mattered, he said the blind flight. Every time. Because that one, he said, was for everybody who came after. I think about that sometimes when I'm in the soup. When the ground disappears and the sky disappears and the world shrinks down to the six-pack on the panel and the glide slope needle alive and moving, pointing me toward the runway, I cannot see. That is Doolittle's work. That is the Guggenheim lab and Paul Kolzman's altimeter and the Sperry artificial horizon. And 15 minutes under a canvas hood on a gray September morning in 1929. Every instrument approach you have ever shot, that is where it comes from sources today, from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum archives, and Carol Glein's biography of Doolittle. More at RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Trust the panel.